From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. How well do you know the people who raised you? That's a central question in a new book by Michelle Norris, co-host of NPR's All Things Considered. In writing it, Norris found herself unexpectedly confronting hard truths about her own family's racial history that had been left unsaid by her parents. From her grandmother's work as an itinerant Aunt Jemima peddling pancake mix, to her father's shooting by the Birmingham police within weeks of his discharge from service in World War II. Michelle Norris is my guest this hour. She'll tell us about her book and evolving attitudes towards race in America. A conversation with Michelle Norris follows this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and my guest this hour is Michelle Norris. Her voice is heard by millions every weekday as co-host of NPR's All Things Considered. Before coming to NPR, Norris served as a correspondent for ABC News. She's reported for The Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, and The Los Angeles Times on education, poverty, numerous other social issues. Last year, Michelle Norris was named Journalist of the Year by the National Association of Black Journalists. Barack Obama's presidential campaign spurred a type of conversation about race in the U.S. that prompted Norris to expand on an NPR project on the subject and write her first book, a memoir titled The Grace of Silence. And Michelle Norris joins me this afternoon in the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. Michelle, welcome.
Ben, good to be here.
We want to mention, too, that Michelle Norris will be giving a reading from her memoir this evening at 7 p.m. at the Iowa City Public Library in the Live from Prairie Lights author series. That at 7 p.m. at the Iowa City Public Library, and it is open to the public. Michelle, before we get to your book, we feel we have to talk a moment about the firing of your colleague at NPR, Juan Williams. It's all over the news today. He was fired yesterday for saying in an interview on Fox News that he gets anxious at airports when Muslims dressed in traditional religious outfits board a plane. Now, in explaining the firing, NPR CEO Vivian Schiller says news analysts may not take their personal public positions on controversial issues. In doing so, undermines their credibility as analysts, and that's what's happened in this situation. So I know you can't comment on this, or it's not something that you need to comment about, but I'm asking you as a journalist who works at NPR and a colleague of Juan Williams, tell us about that line between analysis and opinion. Help our listeners better understand where that line is and how you face it every day.
Well, Ben, you're right. I'm not going to talk about Juan's situation specifically because I don't feel it's appropriate to comment on personnel matters at NPR. But, you know, there is a line between opinion journalism and standard journalism. And if you pick up the newspaper, you note that the first sections of the paper are where you find the news, and then maybe on the last two pages, that's where you find editorials and opinion. Again, you know, that separation is the same thing exists in broadcasting and on the radio. And that's something that we take very, very seriously. The need to present a product every day in the broadcast and in the individual segments that are fair, that news stories that are balanced, to hold on to our listeners' trust and to always strive toward producing a product that is fair and balanced and shows a good deal of integrity in everything we do. I mean, right now, one of the things that is a bit troubling as someone who believes in NPR and who works at NPR is this sort of easy generalization that NPR is a liberal organization.
A counterbalance to Fox News,
not a counterbalance to Fox News, and we're not a liberal organization. And if you look at our listenership, you will find that it is a fairly accurate representation of the American electorate. A very large percentage of our listeners identify themselves as conservative. Important point there. They identify themselves as conservative. A large percentage identify themselves as moderate. And yes, there are many who also identify themselves as liberal. But we appeal to a broad spectrum of listeners, and they come to us because they know that they're getting a product that's fair and that's balanced and does not represent one side of the political spectrum or the other.
A quick follow-up before we do get to talk about your fascinating book here. In the 2008 campaign, you asked voters in that project you had with Steve Inskeep, What are the occasions when you become aware of your race? Juan Williams is an African-American. You are an African-American. What are the occasions when you become aware of your race? Is this one of them in particular?
He was talking about, you know, another group and their own identification. I'm going to be honest here, and it's something that Steve and I talked about in that conversation that you referenced with the voters in York, Pennsylvania, and something that we heard from many of the voters of color in those conversations. I am often aware of my race. It's something that I think about quite often. And one of the things that we learned in those conversations is that that's one of the differences that people of color often think of their race, think about it when they head out, think about it when they decide what they're going to put on their back, think about it when they decide where they're going to live, think about it if they're young, when they decide what table they're going to sit at in the lunchroom every day, think about it when they decide how they're going to answer a particular question. That it's something that they're constantly aware of. And what I have discovered in working on that series of conversations, and then furthermore in working on this book, that it's something that white Americans don't often think about in quite the same way, the issues of racial identity and what that means in terms of how they might be categorized or how they might be, you know, understood or put in context in a larger sense.
How did that project you had in 2008 turn into this personal memoir and an exploration of racial history in the United States?
Well, it was a sharp left turn, because I originally was planning to write a series of essays about how other people talk and think about race. And it grew out of the series of conversations that Steve and I did with these diverse voters in York, Pennsylvania, around the presidential election. We thought that there was this interesting conversation going on about race that we weren't hearing in the studio, so we wanted to go out and put an ear to it. And at the end of that, after having a series of very frank, very interesting conversations, I wanted more. I wanted to travel the country, put an ear to the hidden conversation. And my goal was to write a series of essays about what I'd heard, about how people are thinking about race and talking about race in more private spaces. And what happened is I started sort of picking up very interesting things when I attuned my frequency to pick up those hidden conversations, because I started to hear things in my own family with people that I loved and realized that there were aspects of their history that they never talked about, profound secrets that were kept from me.
A little later in the hour, we'd like to take some callers, some emails, questions for Michelle Norris, if you have them, about her memoir, about racial history in this country, what she's uncovered in her memoir, The Grace of Silence. 1-866-780-9100 is our number, 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email, and we're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. I was so surprised, Michelle, in reading your book, to see how your family was treated when your family moved to Minneapolis, and this would have been in the 1960s. Tell us about that.
Well, it's a story that I didn't even know. I grew up in a very integrated community in the south side of Minneapolis, a sort of little rainbow community. And I thought that it was always that way. I thought that Minnesota is a state that's known for being a fairly tolerant community. It always had this sort of easy integration in the cities. And I learned in the course of the sort of unpeeling of some of these family secrets that our neighborhood was integrated because my family integrated it, that they were the first black family to move in. And when I heard more and more of these stories, my mother started to talk about their initial reception in the neighborhood, I realized that the parents of some of the friends that I had growing up, people who wound up becoming close to our family, initially were very cool to my parents. When they first moved in 1961 as the first black family on the block, every property owner whose property touched ours, you know, whose property line met ours, put their houses up for sale immediately. And most of the neighbors directly across the street, we had a corner lot. So, you know, of us, next to us, kind of to the side of us, and then across the street, they all put their homes up for sale right away.
And instead of shrinking from this obvious affront to you and your family moving in, I was amused, but also, wow, I was saying what your parents did when the realtors brought people to look at these houses that were for sale around your house. What did your mother do? She sent you outside.
I'm chuckling. Actually, I wasn't born yet. She would send my sisters outside. I'm chuckling because this is an aspect of my mother's personality that I never knew. This was very painful for her, and there would have been a lot of different ways to handle that, to just sort of put your head in the ground to you know, just stay to yourself, to be fairly isolated, to be filled with rage or maybe pain. But instead, she saw an opportunity for a little mischief. And when the real estate agents would show up with prospective buyers, she would send my older sisters out in the yard to play as soon as they showed up to show these properties. And or that she would point, she was pregnant with me, so they'd see another child was on the way. And right. She loves telling these stories. She says that when the real estate agents would show up with the prospective buyers, she'd wait until they got inside and perhaps were very wowed by what they saw in these lovely Tudor homes on the south side of Minneapolis. And at just the right moment, she would say to herself, "Showtime!" And then she'd send the kids outside to play.
And it was not as if the children were dressed in rags. You were an immaculately dressed family.
Yeah.
Your parents made sure that your hair, your shoes, your play clothes were immaculate.
All the time. So they were, you know, probably my sisters were sent out probably in some little smocked frocks outside to play. Eventually, the family that moved in directly next door was black, and all those homes were sold to black families. But the neighborhood did become integrated, and my parents had had much to do with that process. I've since discovered, as I've been traveling around the country on this 30-book tour, I've met so many people who come to hear about my story and wind up telling theirs. And many of them have talked about their various experiences with blockbusting, either remembering the first black family that moved in, or the first Italian family, or the first German family, or the first Jewish family, or being on the other side of that and moving into a neighborhood and, you know, remembering the reception that they got. I mean, it's been one of the most rewarding aspects of this book is that it's started this conversation, and on my website, it's michelle-norris.com, there's a link called Your Stories, and people tell their own stories, and many of them have something to do with this sort of aspect of integration, you know, at a very granular level, neighborhood by neighborhood, block by block.
There are so many secrets in this book that you uncovered in its making that readers such as I uncovered in reading it about. I'm someone who has read a lot about the racial history of the United States, and there are a lot of things that I didn't know. One particular one that your mother never talked about was the time her mother, your grandmother, she spent traveling around as Aunt Jemima for Quaker Oats, and Iowans certainly know Quaker Oats. It has a big presence in Iowa. She appeared in small Midwestern towns in a hoop skirt, a headscarf to perform pancake-making demonstrations for farm women. Now, for those who don't know, remind us what Aunt Jemima represents in our racial history and why your grandmother chose to do this.
You know, my mother never talked about this. She had very complicated feelings surrounding this. And it's because, you know, of what Aunt Jemima represents. I mean, if you looked at the lady on the pancake box today, she's very different than the woman that, you know, she used to look like. I mean, today she looks like you know, she's in the church council or something, that she shops at Macy's or Elizabeth Ashley or Laura Ashley or something like that. She wears pearls and she's got this great hairdo. But for years, she looked like a slave woman. And that's what she represented. She was someone who spoke in these ads with a certain slave patois. She was someone who was not at all aspirational. She was sort of happy with her servitude, her submission. And Mom hated this story. And my grandmother, it turns out, had worked in the late 40s and early 50s, traveling a six-state region. That included Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
So as I travel around Iowa, it's interesting to me to know that she probably followed this same route.
So listeners listening today, some of them might have heard or seen your grandmother portraying Aunt Jemima.
They might have. You know, and this is at a point where convenience cooking was new. So she was demonstrating how to make pancake mix. It's before the add water and stir era of cooking. And what I discovered through newspaper clippings that I found about her work is that even though Aunt Jemima in the ad spoke with a certain slave patois, my grandmother would portray the role in her own way. She spoke with great diction. She wanted people in these small towns who'd often never seen a Negro woman before to know that she was educated and that she thought highly of herself. She served as a kind of ambassador, and not even my mother knew that. I mean, it was in the uncovering of these stories. You know, it begins as a painful family secret. Well, you start to peel it back and uncover it, and you discover aspects of the story, aspects of American life that you didn't even know. And it turns out that Quaker Oats got a lot more than they bargained for when they hired Ione Brown, because she served that role in her own way. She lifted herself up through her earnings, but she tried to lift her people up in some way by taking a role that very easily could have been very demeaning and instead turning it into something else. And I have met in my travels women who remember seeing Aunt Jemima as a young woman, you know, my grandmother as the embodiment of Aunt Jemima coming to their town. And yes, they said, you know, she was very well spoken.
Michelle Norris is my guest. She's speaking about her grandmother who portrayed Aunt Jemima, one of the many fascinating stories in her new memoir, The Grace of Silence. Michelle Norris, my guest, live in our studio at Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. When we come back with Michelle Norris, I want to ask her about the story of her father, which forms the backbone of this book, who as a young man was shot by a white policeman in Birmingham, Alabama. Never spoke about the incident after leaving Alabama, moving north. Never told Michelle's mother. Took that story to his grave. We'll find out about it when we return. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Great to have you with us over the noon hour. And my guest this hour, Michelle Norris, a voice heard by millions every weekday as co-host of NPR's All Things Considered, live in our Iowa Public Radio studio in Iowa City. And she's written her first book. It's a memoir titled The Grace of Silence, her memoir of her family and about racial history in this country. If you have questions for Michelle Norris, 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, or email on Twitter at IPR Talk. We'll go to those a little bit later. Michelle, I promised before the break that we talk about sort of the backbone of your memoir, the story of your father who has passed and as a young man was shot in the leg by a white policeman in Birmingham, Alabama. And he never spoke about this incident after leaving Alabama, moving north. He never told your mother. He took this story to his grave. Mm-hmm. When and how did you first find out about this incident?
I found out from an uncle of mine. There were six sons in the household in Birmingham. My father had five brothers, and only one of them is still living. And my Uncle Joe, who is the last of the surviving brothers, is the one who told me. He just spat it out one morning over breakfast when he was fussing about young people and how they don't vote and how they take for granted, you know, the sacrifices that were made before them. There are so many aspects of this book that were, you know, truly astonishing. And I grew up in a household, a very ordinary household. My parents were postal workers, both of them. And they sort of preached to us that, you know, they wanted us to do great things, but that, you know, our lives were really nothing special. They talked – I mean, their goal in life was to sort of be ordinary. You know, that's sort of who we were. And I had no idea that there were these extraordinary aspects of our family history. And Dad, who was a very mild-mannered postal worker, really kind of quiet, gentleman, had years earlier been involved in a confrontation with a police officer. He had just returned from his military service in the Navy. He was trying to enter a building where I later learned there were round-the-clock classes for returning veterans who were trying to participate in this voter registration campaign. And he was confronted by a police officer who tried to stop him from entering the building. And my father stood up for himself, and a scuffle ensued. And he was wounded when the policeman's gun discharged and the bullet grazed his leg. The wounding was astonishing to me, but equally astonishing was the idea that he would stand up to a police officer. Mm-hmm. Because for a black man to stand up to a white police officer in 1946 in Birmingham, Alabama, was something you just didn't do. And if you did, you invited a special kind of trouble. That story, just learning about that and then trying to get my relatives, the ones who knew and were part of this conspiracy of silence, to reveal what little they knew and then to go back to Birmingham and sort of continue to peel back the layers, sucked me back not just into my family history but into American history. And this piece of history that I didn't know, I mean, I consider, if not all things, a lot of things on the radio every week. And I thought I knew a lot about American history. And what I didn't know was much about the treatment of the returning war veterans. I mean, mm-hmm. My father was one of these veterans who had been transformed by his military service. They went off and fought for democracy overseas and came back to this country with this idea that they might be able to participate in democracy back home. And many of them were met with a sort of horrific embrace when they came back. You know, my father was lucky in many ways, because what I discovered in looking at what happened in 1946 is that black veterans were met with horrific violence all over the country.
And you have numerous cases in this book where black veterans were simply shot or worse under mysterious circumstances.
Beaten, burned, castrated, lynched, blowtorched, killed. Several of them. In the first, my father was wounded in February of 1946. In the first 6 weeks of 1946, a half a dozen black veterans were reportedly killed by white police officers in and around Birmingham. A week after my father was wounded, there was another veteran whose story I tell in the book, named Isaac Woodard, who was pulled off a bus in South Carolina for saying something to a bus driver that the bus driver didn't like, pulled into an alley, again by police officers, and beaten so badly that he woke up blinded. This was 3 hours after he was honorably discharged from the Army, and he was still wearing a military uniform. And I discovered in my research that President Harry Truman was so troubled by this that he wrote a series of letters to his friends. And it was that blinding, the blinding of Isaac Woodard, that led him to appoint the commission that then led to the full integration of the armed services. You know, Isaac Woodard is, most of us don't even know who he is, but
right.
In 1946, it was huge news all over the world, not just here in America. Arlo Guthrie had written a song about him.
You talk about Orson Welles having to flee the country because of this case.
Orson Welles editorialized about this case, a series of commentaries that ran on a Sunday evening broadcast week after week, and he was pulled off the air, and he was targeted by the House Un-American Activities Committee, and he wound up having to leave the country. You know, it was this book, the research that led to this book, this accidental memoirs, really made me think about history in a different way.
So why does civil rights, our understanding of civil rights, in sort of our popular idea of history, start in the 60s or the late 50s and not in the 40s, where you place it and where you are so surprised by these events?
Well, the veterans and their push for equal rights and for voting rights, because that was really in the main what they wanted, was voting rights and to be full participants in the military, was the beginning of the civil rights movement. And when we think of the civil rights movement, we do think about it then in the mid to late 60s. And that's sort of a convenient handle, because it's a part of that story that focuses on the overcoming of something, as opposed to the tyranny and a really difficult history of living under Jim Crow segregation. The reason that I think about history in a completely different way is because, as I write in the book, it's like Harriet Tubman passed the baton to Martin Luther King, and we skip over all of this. But I realized that my family had a piece in this history that I never really understood. Mm. And that's, you know, I called the book The Grace of Silence because I think it was an incredible act of grace for my father and for so many of these veterans to keep their stories to themselves. The reason we don't know this history is because men like my father stopped talking about it. They moved forward and they decided that was in the past. That's like a garment that doesn't fit me anymore. I'm going to move forward and I'm going to focus on hope and ambition and leave that behind.
And in the sweep of history, you think that's a good thing?
Well, I think I benefited from it, but I don't necessarily think it's a good thing in the end. I know I benefited from it. I also believe that if my father had lived longer, he might have told me some of this. But if you have a difficult, you know, piece of your history, it's worth embracing it. Now that I know this, it's an incredible gift to my family. In my case, I inherited or I discovered this complicated racial legacy. But if your family arrived here without much money and lived through poverty, if you lived through the Holocaust or the Depression, you know, as difficult as that aspect of your family story might be, it is worth claiming it because it's your history. And if you then can pass that on to your children, it is an incredible gift. So while I know I benefited from the grace of silence, I hope that this book encourages people to think about their own histories. And I hope that in the end it actually starts discussions, that people actually talk to each other, perhaps about race, but certainly about family history.
Michelle Norris is my guest, if you just joined us. Her new book, her first book, is a memoir titled The Grace of Silence. And before we do get to an email or a call, I'd like to follow up on what you're just talking about right now, because in reading about your father's experience as a black soldier in World War II, how he was treated, you describe in the book, as a second-class serviceman, how the military at that time was struggling with the question of how to integrate blacks in the military, it's hard not to draw parallels with the current debate over don't ask, don't tell, and the integration of gays in the military. What similarities do you see in these two debates? A military, a mighty military, struggling with social change and having to adapt itself. What parallels do you see, or dissimilarities?
Well, one of the big differences is the way you could actually serve. I mean, one of the things that I discovered, and there is a big debate about this, and maybe with the fullness of time, we'll learn a little bit more about the debate, the internal debate within the military about don't ask, don't tell. What I know through document research and through interviews is that the military was really at odds over this, and there was deep hand-wringing about whether men of color and women, there were wax and waves also, but whether people of color should participate fully in the military. And it was different within different branches. The Army, for instance, allowed men of color to actually serve in areas of combat earlier than the Navy or the Marines did. And the reasons for that were interesting. One of the things I discovered is a series of memos that one of the reasons the Army was under pressure, not just from the White House, but from small town mayors who were saying, listen, we have a problem because all the white men are marching off to war. And what we're leaving behind are lots of white women and lots of, quote, able-bodied Negro men who are vastly outnumbering the men in our population, and this is a problem for us. So they were receiving pressure from sort of interesting places to integrate. But the decision, you know, branch by branch was very different, and it spelled out very carefully what you could do. My father served in the Navy, for instance, and when he enlisted in 1943, you had a choice. You either served as a cook or as a steward. And over time, that changed. And the military in 44 and then again later in 44 amended those rules. And in the end, they decided that any marginalization of people of color was, quote, material aid to the enemy. So it was sort of a long process of change. And it will be very interesting to me as a journalist and as someone who has a great interest in history to understand the internal thinking in the military about this, because we hear the military commanders talk about this, but I'm betting that there is a very different and very robust debate at sort of a lower level.
Mm-hmm. So we're hearing the public comments now, yeah. And we can expect the internal debate to be revealed to us in the years to come. Fascinating. Michelle Norris, my guest. We have an email from Holly in Ames, so you can email us questions, comments for Michelle Norris, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Our telephone, 1-866-780-9100. Holly from Ames was so excited, she says, to hear Michelle Norris mention her grandmother worked for Quaker Oats portraying Aunt Jemima. I clearly remember, writes Holly from Ames, meeting Aunt Jemima in the Red Owl grocery store in Rochester, Minnesota as a child in the 1950s. Food sampling in the stores was not common then, so the combination of eating delicious pancakes with my mother, served by this kind of black woman, obviously made quite an impression on me. So you're running into this
as
you go across the country.
I am, Holly. Thank you very much for sending that email. I myself grew up in Minnesota, so I remember Red Owl, which is a chain that is no longer in existence. My grandmother worked in the 50s, and it's quite likely that she saw Ione Brown. There was another woman whose last name was King who was also working that region at the time. So it would have been one of them most likely. And if Holly would want to contact me through my website, again, it's Michelle-Norris, I would love to talk to her because I'm trying my best to collect some of these stories. And, you know, to go from not knowing any of this to then digging into this and discovering more and more about my grandmother Ione to the point of actually meeting people who saw her is slightly surreal, but it is also very rewarding to me to be able to sort of fill in this history. And, you know, and I, the woman that I remember growing up was quite bossy and very polished, and it's sort of hard for me to imagine her dressed up in that Aunt Jemima costume. But the more I learned from her as the people who remember seeing her and through the newspaper coverage that I'm able to find, I learn a little bit more about how she carried herself and how she used this role.
Let's see if we can go to our callers. Let's go to Kendall in Davenport if we can. Kendall, good afternoon. Welcome to our program with Michelle Norris today.
Hi. It's a pleasure and an honor to speak with you, Michelle. I'm a longtime listener and contributor, 15-year listener and 10-year contributor to NPR. But I've just I had no idea until this program that you were black. I couldn't have told anybody any difference. Your level of education, your intellect, and I mean, you're so articulate that your voice just tickles something deep down in my ear that you're such a pleasure to listen to, and I listen to this is Michelle Norris for NPR, and boy, I'm listening, until you say it again, and I know that your segment is over. I'm really intrigued by the story and by your book, and I know that this show really isn't going to near capture or cover everything that's in there, and I'd actually just renewed my Barnes & Noble membership,
okay.
So I plan on getting out there and buying your book.
Kendall.
Really appreciate you, yes.
Kendall, thank you for the comment. Calling from Davenport, 1-866-780-9100. Michelle, you did a number of interviews for this book, and you detail them in this book, the digging that you did, you using your journalistic skills. But with your family members, I wanted to ask you about this. Other people connected with this story, but also family members. In your career, you have undoubtedly done thousands of interviews for print, for television, and for NPR. How did this interview process change when your subject was a family member?
Oh, it's very different. It's very different. And I had the experience of actually talking about the book in Minnesota yesterday with several family members in the front row. And it's a little bit – they intimidate me in ways that even world leaders don't. It was really tough because as a journalist, I sit on the sidelines usually and report from the sidelines what I see.
You get to be detached.
I have to be detached, actually. But in this case, I couldn't be. At some point, the story changed. And in order for me to tell the story, I had to get down into the story. And I had to have a series of difficult conversations with relatives who didn't necessarily want to talk about any of this. When I asked about my father's shooting, some of the relatives were sad that I now knew about something that they hoped to keep from me. Others were very angry that I was pestering them about this thing that they just didn't want to talk about. I had to talk to my mother, and have a series of difficult conversations. Imagine learning that the man you were married to for years kept this part of his story from you, that he was shot as a young man and never talked about it. And then imagine being pestered about it by your nosy daughter. That was not fun. And what I had to do is I had to wait her out. I had to, just gently knock on the door until I figured she was ready to tell her story. And it was a difficult dance. And one of the things that helped me is I have young children. And they would start to ask questions about her background, not fully knowing what I was working on, but just they would hear me talking to her, and then they would sort of drift in the room, and they would start to ask her questions. And one of the most amazing things about children is they have this curiosity that's actually kind of demanding, but also a little bit innocent. And they could get away with asking really direct questions that I couldn't ask. And then I found myself in the situation where mom was talking to my son and my daughter, my young son and daughter, and in a way sort of talking to me, it was like a rim shot.
Mm-hmm.
She was having the conversation with them, knowing that I was listening, at some point knowing that I was also taking notes. And for anybody who's interested in capturing their family history, it's one of the things that I pass on to them. I mean, the National Day of Listening is coming up the day after Thanksgiving, where we're encouraged to capture family history. And I always tell people, use your children because they can really help you, draw
you can
be difficult
a little bit
stories.
Devious. Yes. Michelle, we have a couple minutes left, and I'm glad you went there with that answer because in your epilogue of the book, you leave your readers with this question: how well do you know the people who raised you? A central question in this book. So you're hoping that readers of this book will be spurred to look around in the dark corners of their own family and get through some pain?
Or even at the candlelight at the dinner table. Because we often don't know the full story in our family histories. And parents, sometimes keep things from us. And it's not because they're dishonest. It's because they want the best for us. So they want to present the best of themselves. And if there's some sort of complicated aspect of family history, they sometimes keep it to themselves.
And so what should you do if you feel that story needs to get out and you're personally curious and you deserve it as a member of that family?
Simple questions. Ask a series of simple questions. Do it over food if you can, because any major revelation I got was always at the table, and food always helps.
Michelle Norris, it's been a pleasure. The time has gone far too quickly. powerful book, a wonderful book, The Grace of Silence, Michelle Norris, your debut book, your memoir. Thank you so much for taking the trouble to come into our studio today.
Ben, thanks for having me.
And we want to remind our listeners that Michelle Norris will be reading from her memoir this evening, 7 p.m. at the Iowa City Public Library. If you'd like to meet her in the Live from Prairie Lights author series, it's open to the public. 7 p.m. at the Iowa City Public Library tonight, Friday the 22nd. The Exchange is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Mitchell Schmidt. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. And our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.